Hey everybody, Jason here. Before we start, I have one last minute addition to the podcast. I saw this the day this is coming out. Taylor of her Clericswear Ringmail blog, who I mentioned later in the show with the Whispering GM podcast, has just put out some zero edition D&D reference sheets. These are for, you know, OD&D and chainmail. I've only been able to quickly glance at them, but they look pretty cool. So there's a link in the show notes. Check them out. And now, let's get on with the show.
Well, pop yourself a beer or a cold libation. I can tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from Brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some moody clips of popcorn, fighting fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxing, school month or a movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on, contest and of course you know it's all about games. That's a slogan, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast. With the other Jason.
Welcome back to the Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. This is a Media Blitz episode. It's kind of a System Sunday. We have Rod Hampton, who designed Dragons Beyond, on, and BJ from the Arcane Alienists is joining to talk to Rod about this exciting OD&D. I guess it's a retro clone. It's actually really an attempt to be a retro clone of the pre-OD&D rule set. And we'll go more in depth in that. But before we get there, I have Commodore joining me from Cold Light Press to talk about the Adventure Site contest that Cold Light Press is sponsoring that goes through the end of the month. And before that, I am going to just point out a couple pretty great podcasts I've heard lately. So let's get into it. As far as the podcasts go, we've got something going on that's really cool, and it's happened before, but on YouTube, often you'll get reaction videos. And so one creator will put a video out, then other creators will put out videos and reaction to that. And lately, we've been having that a lot with podcasts. So I did my talk on post-apocalyptic games and Gold Standard and MW over the The Worlds of M.W. Lewis podcast, put out a couple episodes relating to those. I've talked about those in the past, but Carl Rodriguez over at Geomologist Presents just put out an episode, also with BJ, talking about effectively the gold standard, but really what motivates your characters to adventure. It's a really good episode. I highly recommend you check it out. In addition, we recently had a interview over at the Casting Shadows podcast and the Runeslinger YouTube channel by Anthony, where he had a guest on, Crispy, and they talk about preparation for in-character play. And it's a really interesting discussion. Again, all these are going to be linked in the show notes. But in reaction to Anthony's podcast, we have the 8th episode of, and I'm going to butcher this, I'm sorry, Sam Oldie's podcast, where he gives a response to that and a discussion about preparation for improvisation that is really interesting. In that, it also touches on some points that Taylor over at the Whispering GM podcast had brought up in their latest episode. I was trying not to look at my notes, but I have to look at my notes. Sorry. In that latest episode, Confessions of a High Prep GM. Now, all these are going to be linked in the show notes, but there's tons of great podcasts out there. Lots of creators are making podcasts in reaction to other creators' podcasts, and I love that. So please, please check out some of these. They're really interesting. Also, I want to remind everybody about the movie Monday. This month is Time Bandits from 1981. Free Thrall, also known as Spencer, over at Keep Off the Borderlands, is now hosting Movie Monday. So you have to send those entries over to Spencer. Watch Time Bandits. If you're in the U.S., it's on Max, or you can rent it. But watch Time Bandits. Great, great movie. and then send your thoughts about Time Bandits into Spencer. Again, the links are in the show notes. I've already sent my entry in. I look forward to hearing what everybody else thinks about Time Bandits. So make sure you get that in. I believe the cutoff to get those to Spencer is the 26th of January. So get those in. Okay, with those announcements out of the way, let's get to these interviews. First up, Commodore and the Adventure Site Contest. So I have a special guest with me today, Commodore from Cold Light Press, and we're going to talk about an exciting contest that's been going on. I've mentioned on the show before, but I figured why not get Commodore in here to explain it in better depth. How are you doing today?
Doing pretty good. How about yourself?
Excellent. Excellent. So let's pretend I haven't heard about this. Give me the elevator pitch for the contest, and then we'll go from there.
Sure thing. So we're doing an adventure site contest. It's going to be through the Cold Light Press website, which I think Jason said he'll be having in the show notes here. But a lot of contests have been happening recently. There's been the No Art Punk contests. Bryce Lynch, which I know you've mentioned before, he had a wonderful Wavestone Keep contest. A lot of these are reviewer-hosted contests. So everybody writes an adventure, they send it in, it gets reviewed, and then, the winner had some sort of prize. And what I noticed was a big part of the advantage for a lot of these was actually getting reviews. A lot of us, it's kind of one of the most valuable things to get is feedback, is having somebody take a serious look at your adventures. In addition, there's also been kind of a gap recently, I've noticed, in adventure sites. So these are, smaller than a full-up adventure module. These aren't going to be some sort of massive, sprawling, multi-session deal. But anytime that you're adventuring, anytime you're running a sandbox or a hex crawl or a city crawl, anything like that, or just, a adventure of the week campaign at a bar, it's handy to have a whole stock of adventure sites. So this is going to be the Cold Light Press Adventure Site Contest. We already got some submissions. It runs through the end of January. You said you yourself might be making one. You keep on wanting to. I really can't recommend it enough. It's a lot of fun. It's going to be fairly small. These adventure sites, we're looking at something that you can stumble on in a hex crawl or in a city. Call it 4-12 key locations. We're not strict about that, but it's going to be just 2 pages for, actual text, excluding the maps. So if you have maps, you can bring it on in. And I write my own maps for my adventures, but you don't have to. We've gotten some people who use dice and logos maps. Yeah, I don't mind if you pick one from offline. The only thing I ask is if you're using somebody else's map, it has to be applicable for commercial release. Because Malrex of the Merciless Merchants publication, he is actually fronting the site. He has some rewards. Anything from the Merciless Merchants, very extensive catalog, is going to be the reward for the first place winner. And he's also going to be doing the publishing of the adventure site winners. So we're going to have one first place winner that gets the prize, but we're going to have 8 to 10, depending on how many we have submitted. We have 8 to 10 in a publication that we kind of wrap up and we send off. If you're familiar with the one-page dungeon contest, it's going to be somewhat similar to that. We're not going to be doing it for profit. It's not going to be anything big. It's just going to be another community resource. I love putting out stuff like that in general.
Yeah, excellent. I'm very happy that you're putting this on. I'm excited to get an entry in here. I know some of my listeners, like Carl Rodriguez over at Gemologist Presents, likes to design adventures, and he's been doing that and running his adventures at cons and whatnot. So, this is a good place, like you say, to get some professional reviewers to review your module and give, or not your module, but in this case, your adventure site, and give you some feedback. Very exciting.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, I'd encourage you, even if you haven't done it before, just write something up and send it in. The worst comes to worst, you don't win. I mean, nobody's going to be excoriated here. Nobody's being trashed. Well, everybody's bringing something in for a community resource that's for free. So everybody, we realize everybody's putting something in just for the love of it, the love of the community and the love of the game. So I hope to see a lot more entries. We've already got quite a few, and I've been enjoying reviewing a lot of creativity, a lot of different locations, a lot of different tags. It's been a really good community resource.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate your coming on and helping me spread the word about this. And once it's over and the final's done, I'll also share that with everybody, and we'll let people know where they can find it. Folks, go check out Cold Light Press. Commodore, any closing words here?
Not at all. Just good luck. I hope you can submit in your own site. I look forward to
that. I'll get something in. We'll see how it is. But, you know, I'm an amateur. I'm not a venture writer by any means. So I don't expect too much.
The dirty secret is most of us are, you know, I myself am a multi-hundredaire publishing. That's what most of us are in a lot of this space. We just do it because we love it.
Right. Excellent. Well, thank you very much. I apologize, folks. If you can hear the dogs in the background, they're flipping out over something. But again, thank you, Commodore, for coming on. And check out the show notes. All the links are in there. Get your entries in. You have till the end of the month.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.
Joining me, I have Rod, who's going to talk to us about his game. And to help me talk to Rod, I have BJ from the Arcane Alienist. How are you gentlemen doing?
Pretty well. Great.
Awesome. Awesome. So, Rod, I have to ask you, this is a big project. The PDF's 318 pages. There's more coming. You obviously, this is a labor of love, a lot of work, you know, no doubt some blood, sweat, and tears into this. Where did this come from? What prompted you to do this?
Right. So maybe a year ago, I started really looking at the original role-playing game and some of the things that were left undone, some of the things that were promised in the companion level rules that weren't really there, some of the things cook expert promised, things that Gygax kind of left hanging in first edition. And I thought, okay, I'm going to write a supplement called Entitled. It's going to have a wargaming component, so it can still be used by miniature wargamers, and it's going to have a component that can be used by any OSR system to really get into this domain level play. I'm going to unify the economy. I'm going to clean up, make consistent the troop types and all that stuff. So that's what I really started banging out over a year ago.
Excellent. And now that Entitled something we haven't seen yet. It's mentioned here in this rule set, but so what prompted the order of publishing, I guess, would be interesting.
Right. Yeah. So in the midst of that, the OGL debacle occurred, right? There was a potential that the OGL was going to be revoked, or at least someone was going to attempt to revoke the OGL. And I already had a good chunk of a section about magic users and all of the spells, all the magic items, constructs, some of the monsters that might have gotten tangled up in that OGL stuff prompted me to go ahead and crank out the Mage's Companion. So I carved out that domain level stuff as its own separate publication. And then meantime, I had been playing with some friends, doing some OD&D stuff every weekend. Every one of us would bring some homebrew rules and work on that stuff. And I had a copy of Beyond This Point Be Dragons, the 73 manuscript. And so we started playing that off and on again. And I wrote pieces of it, right, as homebrew rules. But eventually, the passion around that, it absorbed all my focus. So in June, I really just started cranking on it and have been cranking on it every morning for, you know, months now.
It really looks great. I'm going to throw this to BJ for a minute and let... I know BJ was curious about, had a question about your kind of gaming origin. So I'm going to let him dive into that.
Yeah, I just, I think maybe to back up just a second, just, you know, maybe tell us and then the people who will be listening a little just about yourself. What do you want us to know about you as a gamer and kind of how you started getting into the hobby?
Yeah, I could go back here on the shelf. I've got my, I got the Moldvay basic box set when I was, you know, pretty young, 11 years old. It was December 81. I got that. I still have the dice, still have the box top, and then I've got the box bottom from the expert set. I don't know what happened to the reverse shells, but anyway, got that stuff over there. Got into AD&D. I'm a forever GM. All through high school, I was running an AD&D campaign that was a mix of, you know, just about everything. We brought in some stuff from Dragon Magazine, Best of Dragon Archer class. I mean, all kinds of fun stuff like that. I also, in the meantime, got into like wargaming, mostly the Hex and Shit kind of wargaming, right? I didn't really get into minis until late in life. But that's my gaming origin. Computer games, strategy games, that stuff came in along for the ride too.
I think that's a variation of a story we hear a lot, kind of in the kind of our circle of kind of our generation of gamers. You know, starting with that, sometimes Moldvay, sometimes it's Mincer, but starting with the box set, and then you get hooked, and it's all downhill from there, right?
Yep. My friend got my best friend who used to live all across the street. They moved like four blocks away, but he and I were playing Moldvay, and then he got the Mincer set, and I looked at it. I'm like, I have never embraced Mincer. So you'll occasionally see me on Discord saying, you know, Mincer's a heretic and horrible things like that. But it's all tongue in cheek. But I think I prefer the way Moldvay and Cook presented it. It's just so clean, right? You can take 22 pages out of Moldvay Basic. 22 pages, there's already like two examples that help walk through character creation, and anybody can play this thing within an hour, right? And with a GM, you can have somebody up and running in 15 minutes.
Yeah. I think that's something about the old box sets that I think John and Jason, you've commented a lot on the Mincer box set about its ability to teach the game, where, you know, a lot of modern role-playing games will have an example of play for people who've never played before, but they really, you know, at best they can just kind of get up at that level. I think nothing beats those old box sets in terms of just teaching someone, and particularly teaching a young person, you know, that maybe, you know, 12 or 13 years old. Of course, anymore, 12 or 13 years old is going to go on YouTube and watch people play and learn it that way. But
yeah, exactly.
Prior to that, you know, that was a very good way to introduce people to the game. So,
yeah, I put gaming down for many, many years and focused on career and family and all that stuff. And then prior to the pandemic, I had watched Questing Beast. Questing Beast kind of introduced me into like all the OSR products. I decided upon OSE. Spun up a group and ran 57 sessions of OSE, and that really got me through COVID, kept my sanity, right? Every Wednesday night we were playing that pretty consistent.
You know, that's interesting. That's an interesting little segue too. And so these rules are not just the OD&D, you know, the original box set or even the pre-release, but padded's the wrong word. You fleshed out some things with some other rule sets, and OSE even kind of slides in here a little bit, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So, you know, the manuscripts, so the Dalin, Dulun, I don't know how the official pronunciation is, but Beyond This Point Be Dragons, right? This guy, Mark Bufkin, has this playtest set of rules. We're not sure how much of that stuff was between Arntzen and Gygax, and we're not sure about. And when I say we, I'm talking about the royal we. We as a gaming community, we grognards, right? We just don't know exactly what the provenance is of every sentence in that document. But it's only 56 pages. But it hints at so much more. And so where possible, yeah, I had to look forward to 1974 and even up through 1991 because, so interestingly enough, there are monsters in Beyond This Point Be Dragons where you don't see an actual morale score. You know, on the scale up to 12, you don't see that until Rule Cyclopedia comes out in 91. So in some cases, you have to look at later product releases from TSR and their other associated companies along the way. to get the full picture. And I tried to grab that stuff as minimally as possible, but sometimes I get carried away.
Well, yeah, and I think even OSE is kind of the big dog right now in you know, old school gaming. And I think even Gavin Norman has a couple of footnotes where he's like, look, this is actually right here. This is not part of original BX. I had to extrapolate this from reading a couple of the modules. And he, as much as he tried to give us a complete game that's just simply a cleanup of the rules, he had to infer some things.
Yeah, there are discrepancies, right? I mean, I kept one typo in there. It's for a vampire. It's like a 13 for the movement rate. And I'm certain that's the 18 that later gets attributed to like the giant vampire bat. But, you know, you just don't know what the author was intending. So I kept that one in there. I think I might have called that out. But there's definitely a lot of interpretation that has to go on writing a retro clone. None of the material is clean enough and consistent enough. Too many hands touched it along the way.
Yep.
Well, you talk about potential typos and interesting things. Some of those typos can make for interesting playing. I mean, we look back like Arduin, where, you know, the typo for layer to liar, and then of course he changed it percent liar in the Arduin Grimoire. But in yours here, when we look at the classes and we look at things like the Fighting Man with the improved damage, you know, every now and then we go from, you know, a positive one to a negative one. And that comes from that original manuscript, right?
It does. And I was actually double checking myself. So Zero Edition, right? That minus is in there. It was originally one column called Fighting Capability. It was that way in the 73 manuscript, and it was that way in Zero Edition. And I chose to break it out into two things. One being multiple attacks, potential for multiple attacks, and the other being damage. Because, you know, if you look at it, it's like one man, two man, three man, four man. Okay. This is an equivalency to the number of combatants that I can take on. But what should I do with this plus one? What should I do with this plus two, this minus one? And I said, well, I'm going to toss that in the damage column and let the cards shake out where they may. Some people might hate it, but yeah, it was a choice. It was a choice.
Right. And we probably won't delve a whole lot into that. Folks, in the show notes, there's a link to Rod's YouTube channel, and he's got a series of videos up kind of talking about some design decisions. So we're going to try not to touch too much on the specifics of the videos, because you can already go watch those. And we're going to try to bring you some new information in addition to that. But yeah, I think the way you picked that out was interesting. And I think one key we do want to emphasize here is this is a complete game. It's built to be a complete game. You've got the domain play stuff you've added in it, but you don't need chainmail in addition to this, or you don't need to go grab that outdoor survival map in addition to this, right? Or the board for outdoor survival. This is designed to be fully playable without having those extra resources.
Correct. Yeah. So if you look at the pursuit rules in the wilderness, there's a lot of that material was adapted. Those mechanics, right? You can't do a word for word. Matt Finch has already talked about this ad nauseum because, you know, people were curious back in the day. But essentially, I took the pursuit rules because those were really interesting. Those were the interesting part of outdoor survival. Took those and adapted them. Same thing for the forage rules that were in there. It was interesting to see that the forage rule from Cook Expert with one or two for forage actually goes back to outdoor survival. And then the last thing, which nobody is going to realize except some of the people that saw some of the insanity I was doing, the hex generation procedure in the back, actually analyzed every hex edge on the outdoor survival map, because my goal was, I in first edition DMG, you have a hex generation procedure, but I wanted that procedure. Mathematically, I knew you could get a procedure like that and generate the outdoor survival map. So I did the analysis. I got the spreadsheets to prove it. If you ran that procedure enough times, you know, a million of monkeys pounding on that procedure will turn out the outdoor survival map at one point.
Very nice.
The things we do for our hobby are interesting. Yeah, I remember years ago, I was sitting at my desk at the time. I had my computer set up just kind of in a an offshoot of our living room, and my wife walked through. I think she was about to go to bed, and I'm just scratching on a notepad. She said, "What are you doing?" I think the answer I gave her was something like contemplating probability. I was trying to work out something about how a dice mechanic would work if I wanted to put it into D&D, but, and she said, "That's just, why do you do that?" So I don't know. I can't help it. That's just where my head goes.
Yeah. I knew it could be done. And then once I got into it, I'm like, well, I got to grind through this. It's, you know how it is, BJ. You get possessed by an idea and you want to see where, if you can solve the problem.
Right. Well, I'm kind of curious, kind of looking through the differences between, but maybe you can inform us, because we've got kind of your sort of cleaned up stream. You know, you kind of, this is a game you've created with Beyond or Dragons Beyond. But since you've actually looked at the Beyond This Point Be Dragons and OD&D, could you maybe just summarize some of the key differences between that Beyond This Point Be Dragons? What's not there, or what's really different from what people who are just familiar with OD&D would be looking at?
Definitely the classes are different, right? So the traits are different, right? So instead of the six that we're used to, strength, intelligence, wisdom, dexterity, constitution, charisma, right? So you've got strength, intelligence, cunning, ego, health, appearance. And I kept that. Experience points instead of XP, it's EP. And actually, you'll see that if you go to the first edition Player's Handbook under the cleric. Still in that first edition Player's Handbook, it says EP under the cleric entry. It's an artifact from this earlier time that somehow didn't get polished out of the final product. But the differences too, there are some spells that are different. There's a spell called the Glittering Eye. There's a spell called Tranquilize. And Tranquilize had a lot more uses if you look at the chainmail rules and paralyzation and how that works. There's a big difference in level progression too. The level progression is, you know, you go up to ninth for a fighter, you go up to eighth for a cleric, just as seen before. There's no thief, just as an OD&D, but the wizard, it has these optional advancement rules, and the spell progression is markedly different. What else is huge that's different? The restrictions on weapons. So with fighters, you have to have an intelligence score that's fairly high to be able to utilize magical armor. Otherwise, you might not be able to use it, which is kind of very different. So it's not a dump stat. Another big difference, halflings can't see in the dark. Elvish is a restricted language.
The way elves work in there. Your magic user, of course, you know, they have quite a bit difference with armor and weapons.
Oh yeah, you can wear armor. Now there's a good chance that your spell is not going to work, but you can wear armor. The same thing. It was very.
I think of all the questions I've ever heard, and all the mental gymnastics we've gone to for 50 years to try to explain why a wizard can't wear chainmail.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a narrative reason right here that goes straight back to folklore and mythology. It's cold iron is interfering with the enchantment of trying to cast a spell.
And it actually says cold iron in the 73 rules. And why that got left on the cutting room floor, who knows? Or maybe this is some of that Arnson material that didn't get passed back and forth, and it's unique to this Twin Cities playtesting group. We'll never know for sure, I don't think, unless Peterson figures it out for us.
I also noticed in here that magic users have slightly better hit points than or hit dice than clerics. It's not huge, but it is a... there's a little bit better.
It is, but then the cleric gets this massive advantage in dispelling magic and an automatic save against magic at upper levels, right? Yeah. So at eighth level, automatically saves versus magic. So there are definitely different balance elements in the 73 playtest, or imbalance, as we found out during playtesting with precision missile fire. it is massively different.
right?
And that's halflings with a sling and elves with a bow have a huge advantage.
You know? They do, but remember, in a dungeon environment, you know, there are line of sight issues, and there's actually, there are things that cut that advantage down, so it's not as huge. Now, outdoors, we didn't do any playtesting with it. Outdoors, I'm sure they're both killers. You know, straight that halfling's a straight up stone cold killer. But he tops out at fourth.
Yeah. It's well, and the big thing, like with we mentioned OSE, is with what you have here for encumbrance. Now, you kept, of course, coins for those of us that like that, but you've also introduced a slot-based encumbrance for people that want to use that.
Yeah, I did play a couple sessions with a guy named Daedalus and his group doing straight up first edition AD&D, and I like the crunch, but I did not appreciate the coin-based encumbrance as much as I did back in the day. I'm like, gosh, I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to make this easier for newer gamers to adopt by giving them a couple concessions. One was a slot-based inventory system, and the other was the ascending AC, which subsequent to publication, I found out that in an early Holmes edition of base, early Holmes basic edition, there was some kind of ascending AC system, which I don't have the full details in front of me, and I can't remember the full chain I saw in Discord, but it made me feel like, oh, good. I'm not completely off the reservation here. They tried out ascending AC back in the day.
Yeah. I think the other, well, there are a number of differences, not at all bad. They're, you know, very interesting. I think one of the more interesting ones, although, you know, it might not come up a whole lot, it's an optional rule, but how you handle magical swords, and the fact that that magical swords are not just the domain of the fighting man.
That's straight out of Arnson's first fantasy campaign, published by Judges Guild, right? When you read the way Arnson structured the rules for that, it's very compact. It's almost like you're looking at zip code, right? it's zipped up in this tight little bundle of pokes and peaks and really tight binary, and I had to, like, string it out into its full ASCII glory.
Yeah, it's very
interesting. I found that very interesting too. That the cleric can use it sort of predates the paladin as a distinct thing. That normally clerics don't use swords, but if they find a holy sword, that's for clerics because they're the holy warrior of the game.
Yep, 100%. The one change that I made with that, though, is I made it restricted to clerics that belong to a military order, instead of making it open for both the monasteries and orders. So that was my little twist on that. But I thought it fit.
Now, looking, maybe we're talking a bit more about Dragons Beyond itself, which you've published. Are there any key parts in there that are not from either OD&D or Beyond This Point Be Dragons? I know we've mentioned a couple of Tunnels and Trolls things you kind of slipped in, and you cite that when it happens.
Yeah, I do. So the big one is the anti-cleric. So let's set that aside, and I'll hit the second oldest fantasy role-playing game for a second. So there, Ken St. Andre and his crowd came up with some interesting rules, and they date back to 1975. And I thought there had to be some cross-pollination in some play groups. And I found experience. There was a rule for daring, which is incentivizing people to go deeper in the dungeon. There was a rule for spellcasting, and there was a rule for saving throws, all of which seemed to make sense to me. So that stuff got imported. There was information about armor from a different age. That stuff got imported. Poison, the stuff that was in that second oldest role-playing game inspired me to make the poison description loosey-goosey enough for every campaign to have its own unique poisons. You know, that seemed to be much more of a factor in his campaigns than we usually saw in traditional D&D kind of stuff.
Yeah, very good. One thing I really like about this book is what you've done with the bibliography and resources and the illustrations and the rights. You know, your citations here are wonderful, and you're very meticulous in making sure that you're giving credit where credit's due.
I tried, and I definitely, it's sad that the British Library was down because a lot of stuff was sourced from there and I couldn't confirm the links. So you see maybe one or two to that stuff. Thank you, by the way, too, for calling that out. It's not like MLA format or anything else. It's Rod's own format, but I did try to make it very consistent and point people in the right direction.
Yeah, you know, I people drawn to games like this, I think really appreciate that because we're interested in the history of it, and you know your citations aren't just to the games, but to a number of different internet sources and different things and where you found these things. So it really, people, if they want to dive in to the history and look at these things, you've given them the tools to do that, which is great.
Oh, and when the British Library comes back on, just look up some of those resources. You can get some of it from the French Library and stuff like that. But the artwork is just, there was so much great artwork that's in the public domain that would be applicable to fantasy role-playing games that instead of using AI, you know, go take some great resources from the 18th and 17th century. There's great stuff out there.
And I guess this is a great time to compliment the artwork that you have picked and your layout choices in here. This is a really easy book to read. It's you've pretty much just done a single column, you know, for the page there. And you have some full page art in here. You have some not quite well, or, you know, 3/4 page art and some bigger art pieces, but the art really fits in well. The tables are big and easy to read. None of this, nothing like Arduin where I can't even read it anymore because it's so small. You know, these old books. This is, I really enjoy the layout. And I think you did a good job picking illustrations to go with the sections of the book.
I really like the illustration you picked for the halfling.
Yeah.
that's not a cute little Hobbiton Samwise. That looks like somebody I don't want to mess with.
Yeah, he's gonna shank you for sure. There's another one that looks even rougher, but he didn't make the cut, so to speak. He was just a little bit. The art just wasn't great enough for it to be used.
I said something I really found interesting here, which I think a lot of people will notice immediately. That is, domain play has always been a part of dungeon, at least kind of old school Dungeons and Dragons and TSR era Dungeons and Dragons, but it gets increasingly less emphasized with each edition, I think, in terms of what the players are looking at when you start thinking about what's the point of play? What am I trying to do when I'm playing a fighter versus a magic user or a cleric? The rules get sort of less and less upfront. And I think what's really interesting here is it kind of makes it very clear, even when you're starting with a first level character, you don't have a domain, but your character is part of somebody else's domain. And to think about if you're a fighter, what baron or what knight you serve, and then you know, if you're a cleric, what part of what temple or what monastic order you have to, it's kind of like the default assumption is you're part of that. And we need to account for that in the rules and those relationships, whether those are with other people who've been playing longer, who have higher level characters, or with non-player characters that the dungeon master will kind of create for you. That has to factor into how you spend your time, your resources, how your character makes their way in the world, that you're not just a lone gun, itinerant wandering hero. You've got social obligations to the people in the campaign setting.
Yeah, that was something that, you know, like I said, I started with Entitled because I felt that the domain stuff never really got fully addressed, right, with the companion level rules, master level rules. But yeah, it's pretty obvious that the intent was there are going to be multiple participants in the campaign. Some of those participants are even going to run some of those factions, and it's possible that you can, you know, attach your star to theirs. Now, maybe the faction starts doing something you don't like, and maybe you start talking to another faction. It could become really interesting for a GM that has the chops to run multiple groups, keep the time synchronized, and all that good stuff.
Carl Rodriguez and I were having a conversation yesterday. We were recording another something for his podcast. And I kind of mentioned we were doing this tonight, and we were talking about kind of why people play, what motivates players. And I had pointed out that here it makes it really obvious that, and that I think the current idea behind sort of player agency and who gets to say what happens to your player, the idea that your character works for another player's character. You come and join a D&D group and you make a first level character, and it's like, oh, by the way, Bob is your boss until you get, you know, get high enough level to strike out on your own. I don't think if there's a lot of players who would be up for that now, but you know, when you hear about how Gary ran his campaign back in the day, where it was like he was basically running D&D nearly every night and whoever showed up to play played, that makes a lot more sense that you would do that. And particularly, I guess when they're still playing it somewhat as a war game, and the idea that we're cooperating, we're collaborative, but this isn't this whole super collaborative. There can still be kind of, we can have our rivalries and our disagreements and our, you know, amongst one another. And that's just part of the game. Now that's sort of seen as, you don't do that unless you have a session zero and everybody agrees this is going to be an adversarial campaign. We're all going to have the right to screw each other over if we decide. That's kind of a no-no now, unless it's kind of stated up front, yeah, that's the kind of game we want to play.
Yeah, you definitely have to have buy-in from the players, right, to run this kind of campaign. First fantasy campaign, right, going back to Arnson's document, he definitely had external bad guys, right, the Duchy of Ten and the Egg of Coot, you know, I'm sure, and, you know, trademark asterisk goes here for whoever owns those rights now. But anyway, he had laid out a wargaming campaign, and he tells you, you know, how, what the budget was and what the initial forces were, but he left it up to the players to align themselves and figure out, you know, how they're going to tackle this stuff, or if they're going to, you know, take pot shots at each other. It's quite possible that during a military campaign like that, you can turn on your ally and, you know, knock over a couple of their strongholds and take them over.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I like in here, I want to talk about the idea of that military campaign here in a second, but I do want to call out that you do have the angry villagers in here, which is great in the domain section. That warms my heart that you've included that.
When I first read through this, I was sitting on the couch and my son was playing a video game. I think my wife was knitting and I just started cackling and they were like, what are you laughing at? I read that to him. This is just, I'd forgotten about that. It's just so funny. It's like, you know, anybody who's seen a movie knows how dangerous villagers with torches and pitchforks are.
That's the playtest language from 73. I mean, and that rule goes back there, and it definitely made it into OD&D. I think Gygax put in like a reference to Conan, right? Sometimes you need like a Conan to come in and straighten things out. But yeah. But in general, this angry villagers concept goes back to probably a lot of those horror flicks, right? The Hammer horror flicks. I heard that Aronson really got into them, and there was a whole blog entry about which movies he might have actually watched on a particular Sunday. And I started trying to find that stuff on Amazon Prime, right? I was really trying to channel Aronson for some of this. So I got pretty deep into the Hammer horror stuff for a while.
No, that's great. So we say this is a complete game, and it is, but if somebody wants to get more into those big battles and that war game stuff, I assume. So you have a product that I haven't bought yet, and that's Men in Metal. And I assume that's more of a war game. Is that compatible to some degree with this?
It is. I'll put a big asterisk here, right? So Men in Metal is based on a company in England and a set of war gamers. They gave me a license, but I agreed that I wouldn't use their names in promotion. I consider this to be kind of promotion. So, but the long and the short of it is there were rules in place through 1972. There were two versions of the rules and some medieval rules. I took all that stuff and did a very, very similar cleanup job because the guy that wrote those rules, he's notoriously obtuse in how he wrote them. And so I did the cleanup. Now, those rules are very much combat resolution table based. So a lot of people are going to hate that because they don't get to roll a lot of D6s and have it really, it's not very swingy. Mm-hmm. It is very much a war game with combat resolution tables, kind of old Avalon Hill style. So I wouldn't recommend that if you're not ready to sign up for that. Go look at Chainmail. That's freely available. Well, not freely. You can go pay for that on DraftThru. But I also found this company, Chipco, that has a war game called Days of Knights that I would highly recommend. It's only $10. You have to go to the Facebook group to get it. But there's a YouTube channel, Medieval Wargamer. He does a walkthrough of Days of Knights. There are even rules in Days of Knights for how a cleric can impact, can inspire the troops and get omens ahead of the battle. So there's room for clerics. It's got rules for leaders that are, like Medieval Wargamer will say in his review, very RPG-like. And the troop classes are very similar. So I think for people that want an alternative to chainmail that might be a little bit better written and uses D10s, by the way, check out Chipco's Days of Knights. I recommend that over even my own product. So,
Okay. Good to know. Yeah. And I guess the other thing I was going to ask, and this is a future product, and not to put pressure on you to get it out, but you have Heroes and Hulks waiting in the wings. Maybe just give us a tease of what that is.
Yeah, so I wanted to include naval war game rules. That's the one big omission that's not in here, right? Gygax wrote a naval wargaming set of rules. Don't give up the ship. He has rules in first edition. You see some rules in Cook Expert, but they're not good. They're not good enough, and they're not tied well enough to the historic reality. I wanted something that would cross over between naval wargaming and OSR and be compatible with both worlds. I think I'm on the right track there, but it's not fully baked yet. But I've done the research. All the ship classes are baked. I got a spreadsheet. And anyway, the short answer is it's going to be the next thing I'm going to produce.
Nice. And included here, if folks are curious, is a complete set of aerial rules and a very nice one with some great recommendations on how to represent that miniature wise and get the kind of 3D effect to get the different altitude effects and things you've discussed, because that's so important with aerial combat. If you think about it, I mean, so.
Yeah. Even going back to chainmail, I mean, he says use the dowel rods in chainmail. So you see reference to that, but what I really used was, just a couple of the round bases that were fairly thick, just enough so you can see the height differential, because that's all that you really need is a little bit of altitude on the table.
So I guess the real question we need you to answer for us is, what haven't we asked you about these rules that you wish we'd have asked you? Or what should people know that we haven't, asked about yet?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think the thing that people should be aware of is they can take sections of these rules. They're fairly modular, right? So they can be pulled into any OSR game. They're meant to be compatible. Go ahead, BJ.
I said, I'm already doing it. I've been on the lookout for a couple of years now about a good, concise way from the beginning to say, your characters need to have a place in the world. Mm-hmm. I've really been wanting that sort of, what I never really thought to say until I saw this, it's domain play before you've earned a domain. We got to think about whose domain you actually have an obligation to, or what faction you belong to from the get-go, and have that. If you want to go rogue with the first 5 minutes of the game, that's fine. But now we've at least established.
Yeah. We've established who you are and what your relationship is with the world. Yeah. But I'm really happy with the anti-cleric section. I think I referred to that earlier, but didn't flesh it out. All the spells, though, they're non-canonical, right? I came up with all those spells because I thought that the cleric really deserved a nemesis and one that had equivalency instead of just a handful of reverse spells. It really is chaos poking you in the face, lawful clerics. So check out the anti-cleric section. I'm pretty happy with how it turned out.
No, it's great. And again, the illustrations you have in that section are great too. We get sacrifice and all kinds of things going on there.
Gustave Doré I don't know how the French pronunciation would be, but Gustave Doré was an artist and he has some great fantasy art. Just Google him and go find some stuff on the French Museum to website to look at. He's got great stuff.
So, folks, I would highly recommend this rule set. You know, it's $10 PDF, but you get a 318-page rule set, a complete set of rules. It's well laid out, easy to read. And if you're curious about playing the original game and, you know, with, you know, some house rules or some, you know, adjustments, this gives it to you. But it gives you a complete game that's easy to parse, easy to read. You're not going to be scratching your head wondering what they mean or having to reach for other books. So I'm interested to give this rule set a shot. And hopefully at some point we'll get to do that.
Awesome. I hope you have fun with that. Let me know if you need any DMing tips. It's the combat's a little bit different to run.
It is, but you give us examples in here though, which is good too.
Yeah. Try to. BJ, any parting thoughts? What are we missing here?
I don't think anything else. Just I think it's worth buying to play. It's also just worth buying as part of a link to kind of the history of the game and to kind of get a window into what could have been if Gary had not cut some sections out from the original box set. And I think it's just entertaining to read. Again, as Jason has said, it's well laid out and easy to read. Good artwork, good tables. So, you know, whether you intend to play it or whether you're just a collector of role-playing games, I think it's worth taking a look at. And I know when you get the print on demand up and going, I'll probably go ahead and order a print copy to put on the shelf.
Yeah, that's going to be a labor of love because I have to redo some of the image work to 300 DPI. But anyway, yeah, I appreciate all the positive feedback, guys. Really makes me feel good that I've done right. I think I was on the right track when I did this.
Yeah, and I don't know if we call it, you mentioned the Hex Generation. Folks, this has the Dungeon Generation in here. We've got, you know, all the things you would think of you need for a complete game are in here. It even has an interesting section on using chance cards and what to do if you don't have standard polyhedral dice. And there's, you know, it's jam-packed with all kinds of great stuff. Like Rod mentioned, even if you use this as something to just pull sections out to plug into your game, there's a lot here. There really is. So I think that's all I have right now. When hopefully when you get Heroes and Hulks out, maybe we'll get you come back on. We can talk about that. And maybe by that time we'll play some and we'll have some actual questions for you from play.
So that's awesome. Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me on. This has been a blast.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I hope you have a great evening and lots of luck with this release. And just real quickly, I guess we should mention, we'll let everybody go. We mentioned Men in Metal, which you also have reference sheets and token sheets, which I assume those token sheets are probably useful for other games as well.
Yeah, 100%. You can use those for your virtual tabletop or use them to, you know, if you don't want to get all in on minis, just print out a couple sheets, glue them down with a glue stick to some cardboard backing, cut them out, and now you're in business.
And then the last product that we haven't talked about here on the show is the Mage's Companion.
Right. Yeah. So the OGL is what prompted that, but it's got rules for, it's very similar. Like if you haven't already looked at Adventure Conqueror King system, they have some very similar mechanics that inspired me, but I also went off the deep end and how wizards can whip together a hybrid species and some other things that I did with magic research around what components you need to put together a particular magic item and what celestial sign you might have to do the work under. So yeah, it should be fun for, again, meant to be modular. Hopefully your magic users can find something to have fun with there.
Right. And that's 143 page PDF, folks. There's a, if you need to something fun for magic users, there you're going to find something in there. So I just want to make sure we got a quick plug into that.
Building your own dungeon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and traps too, right? So that was one thing from first edition, right? You have a table and traps, but there's no guidance, right? If you're a dungeon, if you're a wizard who wants to protect your very valuable spell book and research and all that good stuff, how do you get some traps in your dungeon? The DM's either going to have to come up their own system. I tried to do that mental work for you. So there's a consistent, a pricing mechanism you can use that should fit in with the economy of the rest of the game.
Very nice. Excellent. Well, Rod, again, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. And I hope to talk to you soon. And, you know, Rod's around a number of Discords. Folks, if you're interested and curious, you're on Taylor's Discord, the Clerics or Ringmail Discord, I believe. Yeah.
Yep. I'm on there. Daniel Norton's, a couple other places. Yeah. Yep. OSC. Yeah.
So if you're on Bandits Keep Discord, the Clerics or Ringmail Discord, you'll be able to find Rod. And if you have questions, you can ask him questions there. So
100%.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen. I hope you have a great night.
Good to see you guys.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Maybe it's your auntie or a joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I could shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. I want some more, bring on the gore. Well, your butcher is a dice man and your moil is by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away, don't look away, don't look away, don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world has gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.